another edition of the Sensitive Skin Podcast. I'm your host, Bernard Meisler. I'm the editor-in-chief of Sensitive Skin Magazine. And we have a very interesting guest today. It's musician, guitarist Mark Howell. He's also a musical archaeologist. He has played with so many great musicians over the years. Elliot Sharp, John Zorn. He was an original member of the of Fred Frith's guitar quartet. He was in Curlew. He was part of Timber along with Rick Brown, who has gone on to some kind of indie fame, at least with $75 Bill. And Jenny Wade was playing bass with that group. Author of Mayakovsky Maximum Access. And we had a good talk. We talked about a lot of stuff, talked about his different bands. And Mark also tells his classic meeting with Jerry Garcia story. Oh, yeah, and we'll also listen to a few clips of some of Mark's music, what he's working on now, the electronica style music that he's doing now. We'll also hear a Curlew clip and a clip from Timber. And you've heard part of this clip because it's the introductory music for this podcast. So we'll actually hear that entire clip, a song called Anti-Mother-in-Law Car by Timber. All right, without further ado, here is my conversation with Mark Howell. How's it going, man?
Oh, it's good. Good. Yeah. Great.
Mm-hmm. So where?
How about you?
You know, hanging in there, as they say. Yeah. So where are you these days?
Well, I'm in the Arklamas, where Arkansas and Louisiana and Mississippi all meet.
Arklamas. That's a new one. I've not heard that one before.
You know, that's the cradle of civilization in the Western Hemisphere, actually.
Uh-huh. Is that where all those ancient Indian cities were found buried in the hills?
Yeah, it is. It's pretty hot archaeologically because some of these sites have only been excavated since about, I don't know, 2005, and uh-huh. Some of them are 6,000 years old. You know, monumental architecture, so it's pretty fascinating.
That's pretty cool. And do you guys call it the tri-state area?
No.
It seems like every place I've ever been is called the tri-state area. Not California, but just most other places they call it the tri-state area. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what are you doing there?
Well, I run a it's an archaeology park and museum. It's called Winterville Mounds. Mm-hmm. And I got into it through music archaeology, actually. I came down here, you know, I'm from Mississippi originally, and I was visiting my folks one summer and went on a dig in the Mississippi Delta and met this guy, John Conaway, who's the Indiana Jones of the Southeast. And he told me that he was analyzing LaSalle's trading bells. He had like 1,500 of these things that had just been recovered from a shipwreck in Matagordo Bay, Texas, off of Galveston. And I said, well, somebody ought to do an acoustic analysis of those because they're sound makers. And he said, well, you want the job? And I said, yeah, sure. And so I analyzed these bells. You know, these are like jingle bells, but the French were trading them for favors with the Native Americans down here. And that was pretty propitious because it led to a publication in a German archaeology journal and then a presentation at that conference in Berlin. And then I was doing a fellowship there in Berlin for, I don't know, about 3 years with a research project called TOPOI, from the Greek acronym, having to do with space. And we were the whole thing was archaeologically focused, but you know, dealing with how to take examples of space in the ancient world to make for better use of space in the modern world. And yeah, it was a great idea. And I was part of the acoustics team. So I was doing acoustic analysis of, you know, sound makers and rooms and open spaces and things like that. And yeah, matter of fact, we're going to have a book coming out about that research. I just saw the jacket design today. So that's, you know, that sort of work led me to take this job at this site in the Mississippi Delta. It's right on the river, and it's there's a bridge that connects it to Arkansas, and there's a pretty little town called Lake Village that's on an old oxbow lake of the Mississippi River. And so I built a house over here, and I've been here since New York. Well, since Berlin.
Okay, so I thought you'd move to Georgia after you left New York.
No.
Okay. Well,
further west.
You're one of the I gotta say you're one of the few people I've known from Mississippi who moved to New York and then moved back there. Yeah, I don't know why I thought you were. I thought you were a music professor at Georgia Tech or something like that. That's what I thought you were doing.
That would have been great. Yeah, the thing was, I would have liked to have been. And I got this PhD at CUNY in ethnomusicology, and I had also got this master's degree in music composition, and I thought, okay, the combination of those two things, I should be a shoo-in for a teaching job. But it never came to pass. I did some adjunct work, mostly in the New York area. Yeah, probably about 5 years after you left, you and Jenny. Teaching would have been great, but it just wasn't in the cards.
Yeah. So how did you end up in New York in the first place?
Well, that's a story I tell a lot.
But we haven't heard it yet on this podcast.
So. Okay. Well, I was always musically inclined, and I had this suspicion that at some point I was going to try to make it as a career in a large metropolitan area. I went to New York in 1974 for the first time. I had a friend who was going to graduate school at Columbia. He finished high school really early, and I was just blown away with the city, even though that was, you know, the era when Gerald Ford told New York to take a hike.
Right. That was the best time to be there, right? Because you could rent an apartment for $60 a month. And
exactly. Yeah. And Times Square was, exciting and dangerous, as was, you know, the Lower East Side, East Village, and everywhere else.
80% of Manhattan.
right. Well, I actually came back, though, after a year, but I had it in the back of my mind, okay, I'm going to eventually go there, but I need to get my act together a little better. So I at this time, I'll confess that I was abusing a lot of drugs and alcohol, and that came to a head about 1980, and it was getting really dangerous and life debilitating, and you know, as far as a future in anything was concerned. So I decided I was going to attempt to get sober. And part of that, you know, I had like this punch list, okay, for this to make sense, I need to have a goal. And my goal is going to be I'm going to take this music thing seriously, and I'm going to really try it. And so I went to a treatment center, went to AA, and And I was living in Jackson, Mississippi at the time. And believe it or not, Jackson, this was like 1979, 1980. It was part of the touring route of a lot of downtown musicians in New York.
Hmm.
And the reason for it was that there was this guy in Jackson. His name was Evan Gallagher. He was a piano player, and he also played percussion with the local symphony. He was very musically inclined. And Evan had inherited a modest amount of money from his father, who died prematurely. His father was worked for the post office. You know, it was just a low-end federal job, but saved his money. And Evan had a fair amount of money to, you know, as a young man. And what he did is he rented this space. It was called the Creative Arts Exchange. And he would finance bands that were coming, you know, down from New York or Washington, D.C. or Boston. And so I used to play with Evan. We did improvisations, and there was a whole little group of musicians in Jackson at that time. And through the arts exchange, I saw John Zorn, I saw Tom Cora, I saw, you know, Eugene Chadbourne, I saw Mark Kramer. I saw all of these people that I would later play with in New York. And mm-hmm. because I already knew them when I got there, you know, I didn't have to present any kind of bona fides. I'd kind of already done that. And
That's always the best way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
When you don't have to say, hey, here, I just got to New York, and can I play in your band? And
yeah, I'll have to tell you my Jerry Garcia story, because I know you and I share a Grateful Dead interest.
I got to tell you, I've told that story many times. I love that. I love that story.
Oh, okay.
Do you want to tell it now before we forget? Or?
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So the first time I ever went to California, San Francisco, I was, I don't know, 21 maybe. And my brother and I just got in a car and drove out there. And Jerry Garcia was playing in Oakland. No. It was actually North Beach. And he was playing with Merle Saunders. And I'd seen the Dead, of, you know, I don't know, half a dozen times by that time. We're talking about the very early 70s. And but this was an environment, you know, he was exposed. And so he's
right, like he used to play in tiny little clubs in San Francisco, even, you know. Even when he was a big star, he did that for a long time. Yeah.
Yeah. So this was like that, but the first time I had ever seen him in that kind of environment. So there's a break, you know, when the band takes a break after, I don't know, an hour or so of music, and he steps off the stage and he's like right in front of me practically. And so I look at him and I say, Jerry, I can do what you do. And he looked at me and he said, well, that might be true, but I'm up here and you're down there.
Yeah. I guess I transmogrified it a little bit over the years. I thought he said, I got it mostly right, but I thought he said to you, yeah, you and a million other guys.
Well,
either way.
He might have, but that's not how I remember.
Okay, you probably remember it better than I.
Well, you know, I was trying for the Neil Schon thing, you know, where he got up on stage at the Fillmore with Santana and, you know, this 15-year-old kid with a guitar, and the audacity of it all, and they let him sit in with them, and he became the, you know, second guitar player for Santana. So I was, you know, I didn't know any other way to get into a good band, you know, other than just, hey, can I, yeah, like you said, can I play with you?
Yeah. So who were you playing with when you first, when did you move back to New York? And I guess I was going to ask who you were playing with at that time.
Well, the
and you're a guitar player, I should also mention.
Yeah, mostly a guitar player. So I'm going to finish off the little the tail end of this story about getting to New York after the sobriety. And so I was in Jackson for 2 years, and the moment I got there, I was like, okay, I'm here to learn some jazz chops because Evan and his friends knew how to do that. I'm going to save up some money, then I'm going to New York because I know that place will work. And so I got a sublet because one of the guys that used to play with us was in New York at the time, George Cartwright. And I'd have made arrangements to stay at his place on Mott Street when I got there. This was 1980, September, early September. So I had saved up $2,000. I was working for the library. And I thought that was going to be enough, you know, to get me by till I got established. And so I got a Greyhound bus ticket, a one-way ticket. I had a little Fender 1954 Princeton Fender amplifier and a 1968 Goldtop Les Paul. And I chained them together to the bus seat. And I had one suitcase, and the chain was just in case I fell asleep on the bus, and so nobody would walk off with the only things I had that were worth anything. And so that's how I got to New York. It was like about a 24-hour bus ride. And then I swear to God, like, I go to Mott Street, and within the first week I was there, John Zorn came by, and he said – and. I said, hey, Zorn, you know, we never did get around to playing some standards. We should, you know, back in Mississippi, we should do that. He said, yeah. Let's do some standards sometime. And we never did that. And I never really played that much with Zorn, but I did do some. I got sort of hooked in with some of the people George Cartwright was working with. And this would have included, oh, I don't know, people like Tom Cora and Mark Miller, Elliot Sharp, David Moss. I don't know. Do you know these? These are kind of improv.
I know some of those. So yeah. When did you start playing with Fred Frith?
Well, when I got to New York in 1980, George, my friend from Mississippi, who was a sax player, he had been in a band. He had started a band called Curlew, and in Curlew was, I'm drawing a blank now. Bill Bacon was playing drums. Tom Cora was playing cello. And Nicky Skopelidis was playing guitar, and Bill Laswell was playing bass. And, George, they had put out one record, and George wanted to do another record, and he got Fred Frith to produce this thing, because by that time, Bill Laswell was playing a lot with Fred. They had a little group called Massacre, little trio.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
Yeah, it is. That record is one of the best, you know, of that, late 20th century controlled improv kind of stuff. And so we... George lost his band right before he was going to do this recording. I don't know what happened, but Anton Fear was supposed to play drums, and he went on the road somewhere else, and Nicky Skopelidis couldn't do it. And so George cobbled together a little band because he already had the studio booked. This was Martin Beese's place out in Brooklyn. And Fred was... scheduled to produce it. And this is where I met Rick Brown, because he knew Rick. And so he got Rick to be a drummer and a guy from Richmond, Virginia named Pippin Barnett to be a drummer. He was in a band called the Orthotonics. And so anyway, I recorded guitar on that Curlew record. It was called North America. It was put out by Moore's Records out of Germany. And Fred produced it, but we didn't have a bass player. And so we were kind of, you know, going through all the songs, and we were, and George was like, well, I guess we'll just add a bass later, which is, you know, antithetical to how you normally record a band. And Fred said, well, look, let me play bass on this. And George said, yeah, sure, okay. And so Fred Frith played bass on this Curlew record. I played guitar, which was a really kind of a, you know, something I'm, I don't know, it's a real feather in my cap that I was I was in a project where I'm the guitar player and Fred Frith is the bass player.
I saw Fred play out in Berkeley, I don't know, about 6 years ago. Jenny and I, yeah. Jenny and I went to see him, and he's good friends with my friend Steve Horowitz. So you know,
oh, yeah, yeah.
Do you know Steve?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh. Wow. Okay. Yeah. Steve and I met when we were both working for MTV doing game development a while ago. But and now he's here in San Francisco. We see each other pretty frequently. But anyway, so he introduced us to Fred, and super nice guy. And we mentioned, oh yeah, this is you know, Jenny, and she used to play with Mark Howell. They said, oh yeah, of course, you know. And the sad part is that there were, I think there were like five acts as part of this mini jazz festival, and Fred was one of them. And there were about 18 people there, and I think it was Jenny and I were the only people who weren't actually performing. But and Fred was doing this thing where he had his guitar laid out, and he was like dropping like nuts and bolts and coins on his guitar, yeah. You know, and I was like, yeah, it looked like he was just doing that randomly. And Steve was like, nope, he knew exactly what he was doing. But you know, it's like, yeah, but it's like that the old joke, what's the difference between a rock guitarist and a jazz guitarist? You know this one?
Haven't heard of this.
The rock guitarist knows three chords and plays in front of thousands of people. Right? So anyway, I'm sorry. I went on a rant. So you, that's pretty great though. You played guitar and Fred was playing bass. So
he was more popular back then. and then I didn't see the guy for many, many years. But during that recording session, one thing, I don't know, we got along pretty well, and he actually brought in a song that he had written, and it was written with a guitar solo in the middle of it. And he said, I want you to play this solo. And so I did. It was the first guitar solo I ever played on a record. And, I'm proud of it. You know, it's a good little cut. Mm-hmm. And then that was, you know, it for a while until, I don't know, 4 or 5 years later, I got a call from him and he said, Mark, you know how to read music, don't you? And I said, yeah. He said, well, okay, I'm putting together a guitar quartet, you know, electric guitars, and we're going to be doing charts and I want everybody to be writing for the band. And so if you can, you know, if you can do that, I already know what you sound like. You know, I'm going to sign you up for it. And so that was, that was great. Mm-hmm. It was really the one gig I had in New York that paid the rent, you know, and gave me an income, while I was doing it. We would do, not to get into the details of that contract, but for me it was something I wanted to broadcast. So I was getting $500 a gig, and
it's pretty good. You know,
and we would do these tours in Europe, and we would play like six nights a week, and you know, for a month or 6 weeks or you know 2 months, and yeah, that money would add up. It was
Yeah,
it was great.
I'm surprised that it was that much, especially back then, because I thought that was kind of like the standard pay for sidemen. Like if you were playing, I don't know, like big tours with, you know, David Bowie or the B-52s or whatever, you know, that you got $500 a night. So
yeah,
because I doubt you're playing
that with the You didn't get that with Miles Davis. I mean, yeah. It's going to be $100, take it or leave it. But yeah, it was that. It's hard for me to believe. But now the thing about it was we didn't tour all the time because he had several projects going on. And so it would be once or twice a year that we would do these things. So it was nice, and, you know, it added up, and it got me a lot of exposure. But that was also kind of a hard life. I didn't get into the, you know, the rock and roll lifestyle till I was kind of already over age. And so I almost immediately was thinking of how to get out of it. You know, just, oh, there's got to be an easier way to make a living. Because, you know, I literally, you know, in the midst of all this, and by this time, a lot of my things were kicking pretty well. You know, Timber was playing a lot, and I had another little band in Europe that was playing a lot, and some other little projects. And it was about this time that I was playing with Zorn, doing these game pieces. And so I, but I was just, I don't know, I just felt like, I get why Jimi Hendrix did drugs, you know, the drugs that he did. I understand why musicians do the drugs that they do because, yeah, you know, you'd be up till, I don't know, 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, just off of this adrenaline high. Then you'd have to go to sleep for 4 hours and get up at, God, you're lucky to get up at 6 to catch the train to the next show. And then, yeah, and you're doing the sound check there, and you're meeting the people who are putting the gig on, and you know, you got to socialize, and you get your you get your energy going, and you do the gig, and you're, you know, it's pumping, and then you can't sleep, you know, and it's like, man, you got to take something just to sleep because you can't survive, you know, you can't function without without that, and then you need something to get up, you know, to wake up.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't think it's just musicians. I think it's anybody who's on a heavy touring schedule. You know, like I think it's the same for, say, like comedians. I remember hearing an interview with Jerry Lewis where he was, you know, saying the same thing. Right? It's like,
really?
Yeah. Well, you know, your show ends and you're all pumped up. You need something to get to sleep, or a lot of times even after. I had my one miniature moment in that rock world where I went on tour with the Spitters for like 2 weeks.
Great.
And I was already way too old. I was like 34, you know, and it was like, you know, five guys in a van, you know, and sometimes it wasn't even as like, well, let's skip the hotel room tonight. You know, we don't have enough money. What time? It's 2 o'clock. Let's just start driving now. And, you know, we can sleep in a park tomorrow when we get there.
Yeah,
but
yeah, and that's great when you're like 23 years old.
Exactly.
You know,
yeah.
Give or take 5 years.
Right. Maybe. Or if you're, you know, like, or if you're like the Rolling Stones and you can stay in the Plaza Hotel while you're touring, right, and travel by private jets, but it's probably a little easier. But,
yeah.
So how did you? So you met Rick on that session, and how did you guys? Did you guys start Timber together? Was that your project?
Yeah, we did. We started it as a duo, I just started doing a lot of work with Rick at the Music Building. You know, that's where Vodka used to rehearse. And,
Where's that, on 40th yeah, Street or something like
something
that?
Something like that, yeah. I can't remember exactly. But, yeah, you go up in the elevator and just, you know, it was like – going through a radio dial, you know, stations as you pass the floors. And you know, Rick, in all his projects, he shared a room with Antietam and a couple of other bands. Anyway, we would just go there and just jam. And it was just a lot of fun. And Rick would always say, I'm not an improvisational musician. And, but he always improv. And, it was, you know, did quite well with it, but I liked that he was always trying to find some kind of order out of all this stuff. So he would record everything, and we would listen to a lot of that stuff. And so we would cobble together these pieces, and they worked pretty well. We had a really nice little rapport as a songwriting duo, I think. And so we did a single as a duo. It was put out by Butt Rag Records out of Chicago. And we had written one song that it's called A Stupid – no, I was going to say Stupid Reasons, but oh, now I can't remember the title of that thing. No, that's it. Yeah, it was Stupid Reasons. And it was almost a kind of quasi-quirky pop song. And Faye Hunter heard that record, and she, unbeknownst to me, was a friend of Rick and some of his buddies. And Faye had been in, you know, part of that North Carolina neo-rock revival that led to the REM and the DBs and, you know, Chris Stamey and all those people. Her boyfriend, Mitch Easter, produced the first REM record, and they had a band together called Let's Active, which supposedly was Let's Party, translated literally from Japanese. But it was a really good band, and I always liked that band. And I never thought I'd meet Faye Hunter, you know, but lo and behold, she came up to that rehearsal space one day with Rick, and Rick said, yeah, Faye wants to play with us. And so that's when we became a trio. And and she lasted with us, gee, I don't know, maybe 6 months. Uh-huh. And then she decided she had had enough of New York, believe it or not. And then, you know, that was before anybody should have enough. Uh-huh. It was like, what are you talking? I used to be like amazed that people would leave.
I know, right? I remember that.
The late 80s or the mid 90s.
I know. I guess I'd been in New York about 10 years, and then my friends started leaving. I was like, what? Are you out of your mind? How can you leave New York? And, you know, now I go back there. I've been gone for 12 years, and I'm like, what are you still doing here?
Yeah, right. But I know exactly what you mean. I mean, you know, both sides of that. And so, yeah, she left, you know, like, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah. But if anybody does move to New York, if you're a younger listener, if you're anybody who's in their 20s should absolutely move to New York. But you got to give it more than 6 months. You got to give it more. It takes at least a year to find your footing there.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Well put. I almost bawled out after 6 months. I don't know. It was hard, you know.
Yeah. No, me too. When I first met there, cause it's funny. It's just like people. There's so many transients, you know. So I remember when I first moved there, and people say, "How long have you been here?" It's like 3 months, and they just like would turn and walk away. Like, you're not, you know. Come if you make it a year, I'll talk to you.
Yeah, right.
Because it's a tough place, right? Very easy to go there and not be able to find an apartment or find a job that'll sustain an apartment, or, you know, you have to get some breaks somehow.
Yeah, you really do. I mean, I don't know what I would have done if I'd gone there, you know, cold. Mm-hmm. You know, I probably would have left. Yeah, I was really fortunate that I had this network of contacts when I got there. I remember the Lower East Side. My apartment, you know, next to it was, you know, a garbage dump. I'm not kidding. It was like 50 feet high of trash.
My first apartment on the Lower East Side on 10th Street between B and C, we were on the first floor. And there was the backyard was a garbage dump, and there was literally garbage up to our windowsills in the back in the backyard. And then we had an air shaft, and the people in the floors above that would use that as their garbage disposal. and they would just dump garbage down the air shaft. So the air shaft also had, you know, garbage up to our windowsill on the first floor.
Yeah, yeah. That's what it was like.
And I loved it.
Yeah, it all seemed to make sense. You know? And everybody had to get mugged, you know. You had to go through that rite of passage. And it was only after you survived that you, oh, okay, I think I can manage, you know, that part of life here.
It's good. So, it gets you out of jury duty. All right. They say, has anyone here ever been a victim of a crime? And you raise your hand. Yep. Been mugged. Then I go, all right, dismissed.
So. Unless you want to do jury duty to make the money.
I hope I'm not ever that desperate to go for, what is it, like $12 a day they give you or something? Or, yeah.
I think it's a little bit more.
A little bit more. Well, I'll look into it, you know.
Yeah, it's like selling plasma, you know. That might be $12. And that, you know, when Faye left, that's when we met Jenny. And, it, you know, it was great. I remember the first time I ever met her over at Stuyvesant Town. Mm-hmm. And I think we traded tapes. And, I knew she was going to work for us. And I was really happy that she was into it. And really, you know, added another dimension and another voice, creative voice. And that's Timber, you know. Yeah.
And how long were you guys together with the trio with Jenny? For like 4 or 5 years? I think it lasted for a while.
Yeah, at least 5 years.
Yeah.
And
just so our audience knows, I should mention that you have heard Timber because the intro music for the podcast is a Timber song, Anti-Mother-in-Law Car.
That's right.
Which Jenny says I need to do more work on. I need to fade it out better or whatever. But
oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. She said I should ask you to do it for me, but you've probably got better things to do with your time. I'll figure it out.
Yeah, okay. We'll think about that. I might disagree with her on that. Sounds pretty good to me. But, yeah, it was a great band. It was a great run. We might have stayed together for 6 or 7 years if we had a second record, a second, mm-hmm. you know, CD. But I don't know. Couldn't get anybody to pick it up. And I guess we were all getting antsy about other things. And,
yeah. And there's a bunch of Timber tracks on Sensitive Skin, if anybody wants to just do a search for Timber. And because there was that, you had the, I think I published a while ago, a bunch of your unreleased songs. From that
Cooler gig. Missing was Second.
And the Cooler stuff, and it's on YouTube, the whole Cooler gig. Or I think it's, is it a Cooler gig or the Brownies gig? I don't know.
I think both, yeah.
Both are mm-hmm. available on YouTube. And I also have to say, too, I remember that Cooler gig, especially because that's when you were introduced to Stephanie, who you later married. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Blind date.
And I remember, I think it was, so Jenny knew you and our friend Gretchen Faust knew Stephanie. Right. And mm-hmm. they somehow, you know, had some machinations and like, let's get these two together. And I don't think I'd seen you play a bunch of times. I don't think I ever saw you play like harder or meaner or faster or whatever. And you just, you know, it worked for you.
Yeah. She says I scared her that night.
Oh, really?
Not enough. They knew each other through Jivak Mukti, you know, the
right.
iconic yoga center. And that was great. I appreciated that. And that's how I, you know, got to be even better buddies with you and mm-hmm. the whole family. And mm-hmm. And you guys lived around the corner from us.
Yeah. And Stephanie was our babysitter for a while.
I know.
And Rick, of course, has gone on to get some, I don't know, what can I call it? mild, massive India claim, mild acclaim with $75 bill.
Yeah, right.
So that's, I mean, that's great that he's just kept at it.
It is.
Mm-hmm. You know, never gave up the dream, and he's finally getting some much deserved attention.
Yeah, I think Salon, you know, the online magazine, a couple of years ago, listed whatever record they had out at the time as one of the top five of that year.
Oh, so. Really? That's great.
Yeah, I know. That's stupendous.
Yeah,
so I don't do a lot of music down here.
So are you? What kind of music are you making these days, though?
Well, aside from this music archaeology angle, where I, you know, I do do a lot of experiments with archaeologically recovered or replicated instruments and sound environments and things like that. But you know, that's a kind of a academic side to me that it doesn't satisfy this need for creative I don't know, outpourings that I had earlier in my life. So, mm-hmm. but what happened is here kind of a very strange thing. I came across this pretty interesting trans woman. Her name is Cami Montoya, and she's like an influencer on social media, mm-hmm. Instagram, Snapchat, Facebook, and all that.
How do I get to be one of those? How do you get to be an influencer? Do you go to like night school or something, or I don't know.
Well, first off, I think you got to be about 30 years younger.
Yeah, maybe so. I've also just recently heard the term micro influencer. I think I might be one of those. I might be a micro influencer,
which I'm
would,
sure
I
you.
Guess would be like 1/1,000,000th of an influencer. Maybe.
Hey, yeah, I mean, that it takes all kinds.
Yeah, so instead of like, you know, 20 million Instagram followers, I have 20. That would make me a micro influencer, I guess.
Yeah, but they're very dedicated. Yeah. Well, so yeah, I've been doing some kind of interesting jamming with her. Mm-hmm. I play keyboard a lot now, like a Korg synthesizer, and she sings, and we'll just jam and then kind of edit these things, and it's really good. It's really inspired. It's I'm very proud of it, and we're kind of, I don't know, messing around with different ways of dissemination, and what we're doing so far, we haven't done a lot of this as far as getting it out there, but we like to attach these little musical vignettes to her video posts, these GIFs. And I'm into, yeah, talking about micro, just the smallness of it. You know, like a 5 or 7 or 10 second long clip that you can just kind of repeat.
Mm-hmm.
And I somehow am satisfied, you know, with that little bit, partly because it, you know, you can, I don't know, increase the length of time you listen to it just by playing it a lot.
Yeah. That's like the piece you sent me on Instagram.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. You got to listen to that thing like or watch it 3 times, you know, okay. For it to really work.
Let's take a listen to it right now.
Yeah.
right. Do you want to play us anything else?
Well, yeah. Let's see. I do have this cut of Curlew, that the very first New York recording I ever did. There's a cut called Oklahoma, written by George Cartwright, that was on YouTube. I was searching there today, and I couldn't find anything else from that record. Although, if you look hard enough, you probably can. Maybe on Spotify or iTunes or SoundCloud or something. But anyway, this song Oklahoma's it's good, and it's not Rick Brown on drums. It's Pippin Barnett, but I'm playing guitar. Tom Corr is playing cello. Fred Frith is playing bass, and George is playing saxophone.
All right. And we should also, of course, listen to a Timber song. I say, why don't we play the entire Anti-Mother-in-Law Car, the theme song from the Sensitive Skin magazine.
Oh, yeah. Let's play that song. There you
Oh, that's
go.
so good. We're laughing because I'm faking this. I'm going to splice this stuff in later. We're just like kind of staring at each other for a minute while we're doing this.
Well, did you want to talk
Well,
about
sure.
these
Do you want
things
to,
in any detail?
I guess we
Or?
already talked about timber when Curly, I don't know. I kind of feel like we're good. Are we good?
Okay. Sounds good to me. What about, did you want to put any other music on there? I mean, I did send you a camping trip cut.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Let's hear it. Well, the system is working so well. All right, Mark. It's been great talking to you. Great to see you. It's been too long. Did you ever make it out here to California?
Yeah, been there about two times since New York, since moving down here, and loved it. Yeah, the first time was kind of funny. So I was going to a conference in China at Tianjin. It was a music archaeology conference, and I got money from the state of Mississippi to go there. So they gave me like, I don't know, thousands of dollars to pay for the plane ticket and the hotel and all that. So I'm flying to Seattle, and we're flying over the Rocky Mountains, and I'm reading this Fodor's Guide to China. And I get to the very last part of the book, and it's talking about
Uh-oh.
your visa. And Then it dawns on me.
Oh,
I don't
shit.
Have a goddamn visa. Yeah, I did, you know, because I'd been taking these trips to, I don't know, Europe and Latin America and Indonesia and places where I didn't need one. And I just, it didn't dawn on me. And so now, it'd be one thing if, like, oh, shoot, I'll just have to eat that money, you know, this is just not going to work. But I'm spending somebody else's money. So we land in Seattle, and I cry to the person behind the desk at the counter, and she says, well, you know, hold on a minute. You can get a visa in San Francisco. I say, really? I said, yeah, and they're going to be open tomorrow, so we'll fly you to San Francisco. You know, we'll call it part of this same leg here. And then get your visa, and then you can fly back. You know, we're not going to charge you for that either, and then we'll put you on the next.
I can't believe they didn't, like, charge you or surcharge you or, you know, double charge you for doing something like that. That's amazing.
Yeah, no, I was just, I must have been so pathetic. I felt like shit. But that's what happened. So they flew me down to, well, first off, the next day I went to, they put me up in a hotel, you know, the airport motel. I go to the counter the next day, and this girl is getting off of work. She takes me in her car to the Walmart to get a pass, you know, a photo for the visa. And then tells me what bus to get on to get back to the airport. And then I get back and I get on the plane to San Francisco and I get there and I don't have a lot of money. And for some damn reason, I'm not using a credit card. I don't know what was wrong with that. But I stayed at a hostel in the Mission District. And I remember there was a restaurant on top of the thing. And I went up there at that night, and I was looking out over San Francisco, the lights and the hills and the mountains and, you know, Oakland and Berkeley and all that. And I felt like, man, this is my roots. This is my real roots. Hmm. You know, people say that about places like Mississippi all the time, you know, for blues or rock and roll or whatever. But I didn't come up on that stuff. I came up on, you know, Jorma Kakawin and Grace Slick and Marty Balin and Bob Weir and people like that. You know, that whole San Francisco sound. And I just super connected to it. Felt so good. And anyway, and everything worked out. I went to the embassy, the Chinese embassy. They gave me a visa. I flew back to Seattle. I got on the plane and flew over into Tianjin, well, to Beijing. And I missed like a day of that conference. But
yeah. Well, listen, next time you're on a flight to China and you have to make a detour to San Francisco to get a visa, we'll put you up for the night. You don't have to stay in the hostel. All right, man. It's been great talking to you.
All right, buddy. Thanks.